Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source, grassroots, and partially solar-powered community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only, and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are its traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. Please get some notebook, paper, and pen so you can take notes during the show. First, we look at some debt-related news and facts for the week. An article from the Huffington Post Investigative Fund, Banks Paying Colleges for Students Who Rack Up Credit Card Debt, by Ben Protes and Jeanette Newman. Some of the nation's largest and most elite universities stand to gain millions of dollars from selling the names and addresses of students and alumni to credit card companies while granting the companies special access to school events, the Huffington Post Investigative Fund has found. The schools and their alumni associations are entitled to receive payments that multiply as students use their cards. Some colleges can receive bonuses when students incur debt. The little-known agreements have enriched schools and some banks at a time when young women and men already are borrowing at record levels, raising questions about whether such collegiate and corporate alliances are in the best interests of students. The fact that schools are getting paid for students to rack up debt is a disgrace, said Congressman Patrick Murphy, a Pennsylvania Democrat and former professor at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. He said that banks' payments to schools amount to kickbacks. Some of the key findings of the investigation: the examination of affinity agreements involving some of the nation's largest and most prestigious colleges revealed that schools and alumni associations sell students' personal information. Many are contractually obligated to share students' names, phone numbers, and addresses with banks. They earn royalties. Banks typically pay schools $1 for each student who keeps a credit card open for 90 days. When students carry a balance, some schools can collect up to $3 more per card. They get cash each time a student uses plastic. Many schools are entitled to receive 0.4% of all retail purchases made with student cards. They benefit from marketing incentives. When a university or alumni association agrees to market cards to students itself, the payoff is greater, sometimes up to $60 for each card opened through a school's own marketing. And there are special perks. Banks sometimes gain special access to athletic events. Cornell University must provide Chase Bank with tickets and priority parking passes at football, basketball, hockey, and lacrosse games. Landmark credit card legislation signed by President Obama 1 year ago curbed some marketing tactics on campuses, but did not prohibit the arrangements between colleges and banks known as affinity agreements. The substance of these deals has been secret. A provision in the law, authored by Murphy, requires their disclosure. But even now, few schools post the contracts online or publicize their existence. Obtaining a copy can take 2 weeks or more. Thus, it's unclear how many of the nation's 2,700 four-year colleges have such agreements, or how many allow credit card companies to target students in addition to graduates. Bank of America, which dominates the market, said it has affinity contracts with some 700 schools and alumni associations where marketing practices vary. At least 100 schools are believed to have affinity agreements with other financial institutions. 17 contracts obtained by the investigative fund from schools and their alumni associations detailed the special access granted to banks, such as allowing them to set up booths at football games. All of the agreements call for colleges to provide students' names, phone numbers, and addresses. For granting such access and information, schools can receive royalty payments based on the number of students opening accounts and the amount they spend, the contracts show. Most of the schools are entitled to earn more whenever a student carries a balance from year to year. Some consumer advocates question whether colleges participating in affinity agreements are failing to safeguard the young people in their care. Universities should place the welfare of their students as their highest priority and shouldn't sell them off for profit, said Ed Mierzwinski, Consumer Program Director for the Federation of State Public Interest Research Group, or PIRG. Three schools, after being contacted by the fund, stopped allowing banks to market to students. Seven other schools and alumni associations, including alumni organizations at Brown University and the University of Michigan, said they have abandoned the practice, even though their contracts appear to require it. The contracts call for a range of minimum payments by banks. At Brown, Bank of America agreed in 2006 to pay $2.3 million over 7 years. At Michigan, the bank in 2003 agreed to pay $25.5 million over 11 years. The bank says it's not taking advantage of students. It's amassing new customers whose loyalties can span a decade or more. Our objective in serving the student market is to create the foundation for a long-term banking relationship, Bank of America spokeswoman Betty Reese said in an email, adding that the bank offers reasonable rates and low credit limits on student cards, and that it primarily solicits graduates and sports fans. Many schools have renegotiated contracts with the bank to limit marketing to students, she said. Schools still engaging in the practice defend selling access to students and their contact information. Colleges say the money helps them plug holes in the budget shortfalls and shrinking endowments. Some say they use the money to grant more scholarships to students. Some colleges and alumni organizations also argue that students need to learn fiscal responsibility, and how better to do that than by having a credit card. The University of Michigan Alumni Association, facing growing scrutiny from consumer groups, says it reached an agreement with Bank of America to stop marketing to students in early 2008. Jerry Sigler, the chief financial officer of the Alumni Association, said he made the decision begrudgingly. Managing credit is as much part of an education and maturation as anything else going on campus, he said. Credit isn't bad. It's a reality. The benefits are not always so obvious for students whose families already face soaring tuition costs and hefty loan payments. College seniors graduated in 2008 with average credit card debt of more than $4,100, up from $2,900 4 years earlier, according to data compiled by student lending company Sallie Mae. On their own for the first time, young credit card users can quickly fall behind on payments. For example, despite having a full-time job or much in savings, Lisa Smith easily found her first credit card on campus from bank marketers stationed outside her freshman dormitory. Once she racked up charges, new card applications poured in from other companies. By the time she graduated in 2005, she had the average number of credit cards for a college student, 4, as well as $15,000 in credit card debt, now 28. Smith is still paying $500 monthly in credit card bills, some dating back to purchases from her college days. I know I brought it on myself, said Smith, who attended High Point University in North Carolina, which says it now prohibits on-campus marketing. but I really felt like I was preyed on. I didn't understand how long it was really going to take to pay them back. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now this week we'll get back to our review and study of The Two Income Trap, Why Middle Class Parents Are Going Broke by Elizabeth Warren, professor from Harvard, and her daughter, Amelia Warren Tyagi. I give an important credit because the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of Professor Elizabeth Warren and her daughter, Amelia Warren Tyagi, who are two of America's leading champions for debtors, and I highly recommend their books, two of them, there are more than this, but relevant to consumers, All Your Worth and The Two Income Trap. I also suggest that you go to the archives at www.kruufm.com, look under Life and Debt, and you can listen to all of the shows which have been produced to help you deal with issues regarding debt. The last topic I was talking about was in an area that Professor Warren calls the cement life raft, and I left off with a very interesting example from her personal experiences. She had gone to Citibank, which was at the time, in 1990, America's largest credit card issuer. She was hired for a one-day consultancy by Citibank to address a gathering of some 40 senior lending executives. Her task was to use research to suggest policies that would help Citibank cut its losses from cardholders in financial trouble. She arrived at Citibank's New York headquarters with all of her graphs and charts, and she was ushered into a large, brightly lit conference room where each chair was filled by someone outfitted in a starch shirt, silk tie, and dark suit. The executives stayed with her all day, eating lunch at the conference tables as they continued their discussion about the effects of unemployment on loan defaults and rising number of bankruptcies among two-earner families. She said that as the afternoon came to a close, she summarized her recommendations. The short version was boiled down to a single but not very startling idea. Stop lending money to families that are already in obvious financial trouble. This would have been quite easy to implement. Citibank had reams of data on most of its borrowers, particularly those who had black marks on their credit report. She suggested the policy could be put into place within a few short months, potentially cutting Citibank's bankruptcy-related losses by as much as 50%. Sounds like a lot of money. Professor Warren indicated there were interested murmurs around the room and several hands eagerly shot up. But before she could call on anyone, one slightly older man spoke up. He had been silent throughout the long day, and he leaned back in his chair and gave her a faintly bemused smile, using her words. Professor Warren, he said. The room hushed immediately, and she realized that she had been oblivious to the corporate pecking order. This was the guy who outranked everyone else in the room. And what he said was, "We appreciate your presentation. We really do. But we have no interest in cutting back on our lending to these people. They are the ones who provide most of our profits." With that, he got up. The meeting was over. She was ushered out of the room and never heard from Citibank again, except to get her monthly credit card bill. So the point is, and it's something we all need to recognize, is that there is a new economics for consumer credit. Citibank definitely understood it and was a major participant in it. Credit card issuers make their profits from lending lots of money and charging hefty fees to families that are financially strapped. More than 75% of credit card profits come from people who make these low minimum monthly payments. I'm going to say that again. 75% of credit card profits come from people who make low minimum monthly payments. And who makes these minimum monthly payments at the high interest rates? 29%. I've seen them up to 89%. Who pays late fees, overbalance charges, and cash advance premiums? Well, it's families that can barely make ends meet. Households precariously balanced between financial survival and complete collapse. These are the families that are singled out by the lending industry, barraged with special offers, personalized advertisements, home phone calls, all with one objective in mind: get them to borrow more money. This is a huge wake-up call. The strategy used by today's lenders exactly reverses the approach bankers used a generation ago when their main goal was to be repaid on time, not to string along the payments for as long as possible, which is the goal today. Back in those days, the lending policies were radically different from those embraced by today's major lenders. In the old days, when a family got in trouble, the lender stopped making loans. The bank didn't call people up and say, "Hey Fred, you're behind on your payments for the fertilizer. Can we lend you the money for a new cook stove?" Nor would the local bank have suggested a second mortgage to the family that had just missed a payment on the first mortgage. And this was a major killer on home financing in the last decade. And as I've said many times, resulted in 80% of these foreclosures that we're looking at. Those were not first home buyers whose mortgages are going under. So those are some very, very critical differences that we see from the past to today. But Professor Warren points out another important difference. When families arranged credit back in the old days, they charged a simple 1% per month interest generally. Neither individual creditors in local stores nor banks had any penalty fee or shifting rates of interest. When someone missed a payment, the rate was still 1% a month. Of course, today, as we all know, that practice has totally disappeared. Banks routinely double or even triple the interest rate the moment someone is a few days late with a payment. Then there are fees. This year, credit card companies will charge billions and billions of dollars in late fees, probably over $10 billion, a penalty unheard of back in our grandparents' days. Also, when some money was received back in those days on a payment that was late, what did they do? They applied that check, that money, to the principal balance on the loan. They would not have dreamed of telling those families that with compounded interest at the new rates and special overbalance fees and late payment penalties, they now owe $4,000 for their original $800 purchase. But that's the way it is today. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So, thinking about what's going on with the credit industry, lenders are routinely targeting the almost bankrupt for extra loans. It doesn't make any sense, does it? How do they ensure that they will get their money back? Corporate lenders don't have a mob person doing the collection, although sometimes the debt collectors sound like that with clients. But they do have thousands of trained professionals who do nothing but hound families for money. Most of the time, these agents make their living by calling families at home, reminding them that they are late on their bills, pressing them to make a payment, using tactics nowadays which are borderline legal, telling young kids that their parents are going to go to jail, harassing people into making some payments. Yet there's also, as we said, the other side, that sometimes they're actually calling to give people more money. Sounds incredible, but that's happening, particularly if there's some asset that can be collateralized, like the equity in the house or an automobile that's paid for. But the typical debt collector starts to use tough tactics when simple requests aren't there to get payment. Sears, America's fourth largest retail chain at the turn of the century, got caught threatening to nab a battery from a Massachusetts family's car unless the family promised to send Sears some money, money that the family no longer owed. Now, this is a clear violation of the law. The family had filed for bankruptcy, so Sears was legally barred from further collection efforts. Now, besides that, isn't it reasonable to wonder what would Sears possibly want with a used car battery? Or with used dehumidifiers, mattresses, Walkmans that Sears had threatened to take back from thousands of other families? Sears was not in the business of selling used household goods, and it would have cost the company several hundred dollars to hire a repo man and send a truck to somebody's door for more than a used Walkman or car battery would be worth. Sears almost certainly did not want those goods. The company wanted the money people would pay to keep the Sears repo man away. The company probably hoped that some families were unaware of their legal rights, and if they were frightened enough, they might just keep making payments on old bills even after those bills had been discharged in bankruptcy. And this is a very typical thing. Sears doesn't do this anymore, but it is still being done by many companies. But in the Sears case, an FBI special agent in charge of the situation, his name was Barry Maughan, he described the Sears case as an example of corporate America blindly pursuing profitability over its obligation to treat the consuming public with fairness and honesty. And at the turn of the century, when a lot of this data was gathered, Sears was not alone. AT&T, General Electric, Federated Department Stores, which owned Macy's, JCPenney, Circuit City, Radio Shack, which is Tandy, General Motors, also paid multi-million dollar fines for making collection threats against families whose debts had already been forgiven in bankruptcy courts. But the caveat is that these companies were punished for pursuing families that were under the protection of the bankruptcy courts, but not for aggressive collection tactics per se. And that's an important distinction. In fact, and unfortunately, many aggressive collection tactics are perfectly legal. Looking back then, Sears, unlike JCPenney, issued credit cards that added some special touches in the fine print. Whenever a customer purchased something on a Sears card, the goods became collateral against the loan. That meant that Sears was within its legal rights to repossess or to threaten to repossess everything the family bought with the card if it falls behind on its bills. And that's even when those threats are patently absurd. Professor Warren had a conversation with, and this is a former Sears collection agent in the Boston area named Sally. Sally's job was to call families that had fallen behind and to pressure them to pay up. One incident particularly stood out in Sally's memory. When another Sears agent threatened to repossess a mattress from a woman who was delinquent on her payments, the customer in question stuck to her guns. "You will not. It isn't worth anything," she said. "Besides, you can't even sell a used mattress. It's not legal," which in many places it's not. Now, Sally's co-worker was quick on her feet, and that person said, "We'll come and get it because we can, and then we'll set it on fire and burn it up. It won't give us anything, but you won't have it either." In this particular incident, the woman caved in and sent Sears a check for $50. According to Sally, the story was widely told and retold in her department and praised by the department manager as an example of real initiative. Since we only have Sally's word, we can't really confirm the facts of the account, but it is a matter of public record that Sears had threatened to repossess used mattresses from other families. And continuing, Sally's real expertise wasn't collecting from the living. She spent most of her days collecting from the dead, or at least the family members of the dead. When a person dies, only a co-signer on the account is liable for the bill. And that's an important point. If there was not a co-signer, someone who signed the contract, they're not responsible for the bill. No one is other than the signer. And we're not talking about a credit card situation where someone is also given the right to use the card. That's a different scenario than someone who has actually signed the contract. Big difference. But many people think that that second person who's just allowed to use the card is also responsible for the debt when the debt collector comes around. But in this kind of case, when a person dies, only a co-signer on the account is liable for the bill. If no one has co-signed, the store can repossess the goods, if the original contract permit this, or collect from the estate of the decedent, but they cannot hold other family members liable for the debt. That's a very important principle. The company is not, however, prohibited from trying to collect from the family. And in this particular situation, Sally's job was to call the adult children of grieving widows of customers, the adult children or grieving widows of customers who had died, leaving an outstanding bill. She typically started a call with something gentle and confidential. For example, Mabel was a longtime member of the Sears family and was sure she would have wanted her bills to be paid. Sally then read from a list of purchases Mabel had made on her Sears card, inserting some personal comments. I see she bought eyeglasses and some baby clothes. I love those sweet little sweaters and matching caps, don't you? So that's the soft sell. But if the soft sell didn't work, Sally would turn up the heat, threatening to send a collection agent who would plow through the deceased's closets and drawers and take back whatever belonged to Sears. If that wasn't enough, there was a final warning that must have sent families running for the checkbook. She threatened to reclaim every gift ever purchased on the Sears card. Again, we have to understand from a legal perspective, this kind of claim seemed ridiculous. How would a Sears agent ever figure out that Mabel had given the frilly dress to her grandniece in Detroit while the Walkman had gone to a great-grandson in Denver? But these threats were to put grieving family members who had just lost a loved one, not to battle-hardened debt dodgers who were primed to defend themselves. So, not surprisingly, Sally said that most families paid. Professor Warren only had Sally's word to go on here, and it was possible that Sally wasn't telling the whole truth or that she had an axe to grind with her former employer, Sears. But a statement by former Sears CEO, Arthur Martinez, is certainly in keeping with Sally's story. He explained the company's aggressive debt collection practices this way. We have an old-fashioned view. People should pay for what they take. As he touted that old-fashioned view of debt, Mr. Martinez seemed oddly blind to the fact that Sears is no longer an old-fashioned merchant. At the time Mr. Martinez made his statements, Sears reportedly earned more money from the interest and late fees the company charged its credit card holders than it earned from selling merchandise. In other words, Sears kept all of those stores open and sold all of those Lady Kenmore washing machines and Craftsman tools in the hope that its customers would buy on credit and pay over time. Merchants like our grandparents who had stores, they offered credit as a way to increase store purchases. But for stores like Sears, the formula was now turned upside down. Store purchases have become a way to increase credit card debt. Now that's not old-fashioned at all. Indeed, it's only possible in the new world of uncapped interest rates and deregulated lending. And we will continue with this analysis next week. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.